But welcome into audiobook narration for beginners. I'm J. Rodney Turner, and today our guest is Sean Pratt. Sean, say hi.
Howdy, everybody.
Sean is a prolific narrator. I think last year, just near the end of the year, recorded his 1,000th title. I'm just a little bit behind at 111, so y'all pray for me. Sean, as you know, you and I have talked, and in episode one of my podcast, which was released on the 7th of January, I explained to people about your YouTube video about So You Want to Be a Narrator. Talk a little bit about, first, a little bit about how you got started, and then go into why you decided you thought that YouTube video would be helpful.
How did I get into it? The short version of that story is, I was doing a play down in Washington, D.C. back in 1994, I guess it was. I was a classical theater actor for a long time. I worked off Broadway with a company and did classics at regional theaters. And so I was in Washington, D.C. doing a show, and I met a guy there who did audiobooks, and he and I hit it off. And he happened to say, well, if you ever move into this area, I can introduce you to some people down here. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. About 2 years later, in 96, I moved down to that area. And he did introduce me to a gentleman named Grover Gardner, who's a real icon in our industry. Grover is he's in the Thousand Club as well.
Sure.
And it's a small club, but he's one of them, for sure. And basically, I went over and cajoled and schmoozed my way into Grover cutting a demo for me and shopping it around, and I pestered him until he, in desperation, contacted Books on Tape and Blackstone Audio and said, please send me a book. This guy's driving me nuts. And I was a little desperate. I'd moved down there thinking I had a bunch of theater work. I was relocating to that area.
Sure.
And the plays I'd lined up had all fallen through. And so I'd been a handyman and a carpenter. That's how I got through college. I was a house framer, and then I became a house painter and plasterer and wood carver and stuff. But I didn't have a car, and I didn't really want to start doing that again in Northern Virginia.
Right.
So I really, really went after this with a vengeance. But the thing is that at the time, it was only going to be one more thing I did as an actor.
Right.
You know, by that time, I'd been working in theater, I'd done film and television, I had done modeling, corporate narration, corporate convention work, and a little bit of everything like you do as a, you know, when you make your living as an actor.
Right.
And I was just going to tack that on. And then I just happened to be in the right place at the right time when the industry was really starting to take off in 96. And I had the right voice for a lot of material. And soon after working with BOT and Blackstone, I started working with a number of smaller audio companies around the country. And I went full time within a year or two after starting. And it was a steady check. It was a lot of fun. Got to work at home in my pajamas. What's not to like?
Yeah, boy. You know?
And but what happened was I began to, and I still did theater and film when I wanted to, and I was still, and by this time I was getting close to recording a book a week and still doing these other things. But I would go to like actor parties or networking events, and I would be one of the only people in the room who did audiobooks, and then I would get cornered, as it were, by other actors about, well, how do you get into that? Tell me all about it.
Right.
Let me take you out for a cup of coffee and pick your brain and whatever.
Yeah.
And at first I was very flattered. I was very flattered for the attention, of course. But after a while you realized I was telling people all of this stuff and no one ever followed up with me. And I realized I was missing an opportunity to maybe network with the people I wanted to network with at that event, or just relax at a party. And so out of frustration, I came up with that video where I talk about the test.
Right.
And I say, you know, take this, you know, and I average about 1 to 3 emails a week from people all over the world, literally the world, saying, you know, my friends say I have a great voice, or I listen to your book, or I really want to get into audiobooks to read, you know, whatever. Whatever reason, I say, okay, and I just give them the link.
Yeah.
And now I think close to 80,000 people have watched that video, which just blows my mind. But so that's, I mean, so really it was more a matter of making that video was a matter of sort of keeping my sanity, as it were.
And you do, you're in Oklahoma, so you do most of your work out of your home. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, with the advent, even when I first started, you know, you can work anywhere.
Sure.
I've now granted in the beginning of audiobooks, it was New York and LA. And then there was also Washington, D.C., which is a place that most people wouldn't think, but it had two things going for it. It had the Library of Congress,
right,
and the School for the Blind, and
right,
they needed narrators. So there was a place for people to train. And as the only way audiobook companies, you know, initially audiobooks were sort of a marketing gimmick back in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
And the biggest player was Recorded Books, which is still the biggest player, next to Audible, I guess. And they sold into libraries. They really wasn't that much in retail sales. But as the growth of the industry started going up by orders of magnitude, the audiobook companies realized they could not produce the volume they needed under the old working model, which was it took four people to make one audiobook.
Right.
The producer, the engineer, the director, and the talent. And so that's where home-based studio narration started coming to the fore. And that's when I happened to intersect the industry. So I've always worked from home. I could probably count on one hand the number of times I've worked in a studio to record an audiobook out of the 1,000 books I've done.
Right. And you get most of your work from where?
Oh, you know, for a long time, my biggest client was Gildan Media.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with Gildan, Gilles Dana was the gentleman's name. Easily half of my work came from him for well over almost 15 years. And then recently he sold his company to Recorded Books.
Right.
And what's happening right now in the industry, there's been a fair amount of consolidation. Recorded Books is like the 800-pound gorilla. It's part purchased it's purchased Tantor, Highbridge, Gildan, and now Christian Audio. So now those were all my clients. And now all of them are being cast from one office.
Right.
So you have to, you know, in some ways it makes your life a little easier, in some ways a little tougher, because maybe the people who are doing the casting there think, well, Sean has a book. What is he, what is he knocking on our door for?
Right.
And what they don't realize is back in the old days, I would be working all those different lines because I'm very good at schmoozing, and I'd have books lined up for weeks and weeks in advance. But Gildan was my biggest client for a long time. But one of the things I teach and one of the things I do is, just like they say, when you invest on Wall Street, you need to diversify your portfolio. So I work with all of those people, plus Recorded Books, plus Blackstone, plus HarperCollins, Penguin Random House. I'm one of my goals, speaking about being in the business, is to get on the roster with Brilliance. I did a book for them about 20 years ago, and I haven't had the time to really follow up.
Right.
I want them as a client now. So you're always looking for, and that doesn't even count, you know, when authors come to me and want me to do their book privately.
Sure.
So there's diversification is key.
So you mentioned smoozing, and, you know, networking and interacting for the newest of new narrators with, APAC being around the corner this summer. And you know, mixers being available, conferences being out there where people can go and meet other narrators and publishers and things of that nature. What's the kind of advice you give your students who are newest to brand new, about developing relationships with the publishers, like some of those most successful relationships you have?
Well, number one, be patient. It takes time. You know, APAC is literally a day and a half long.
Right.
You know, the night before it happens, there's a cocktail mixer there in Manhattan, usually at the Boathouse on the Upper West Side.
Right.
But it's a loud, raucous affair.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have APAC, and it's a series of panel discussions. And now Johnny Heller has his event the day before APAC, but that's really a teaching event. So the only time you're really going to be exposed to people is that day and a half. And it's a very narrow window of time. And you also have to understand that those people who are there, who, you know, you want to get to know, are going to be you know, just swamped with people just like you trying to make that connection. So you have to, you know, APAC is a good place thing to start off with. I think everybody needs to go a couple of times to get the feel, because, and also, you know, there while you're there, they do, I think the APA does a thing called Director's Diagnostic, and they also do speed dating, where narrators are chosen in a lottery to, you know, meet for 5 minutes with a series of, like, I don't know, 10 or 20 different casting people from all these different companies. You know, they ring a bell every 5 minutes and you go to a different table. So there are definite advantages if you have those things. But I also push my students to apply. They're now doing cocktail mixers through the Audio Producers Association, and they're doing speed dating throughout the year. In fact, there was one back, I think, early December. I had about half a dozen students who went to that. So there's other avenues too. I mean, ultimately it's a math game. Right. You want to get to a place where there are fewer of you narrators,
right,
with, and more of them. But you know, and there's, as far as, you know, technique goes, you know, networking 101 is not about telling everybody all about you and then saying, give me a job. Networking is really about establishing a connection with that person on a personal level. You have to move the needle. You know, you have, when you meet a new person, even whether it's a, you know, just a, like if I were to meet you at a gathering and I didn't know you and we just start talking, oh, you're a narrator, I'm a narrator too. But in a business context and this thing, you go from absolute stranger on the one end of the needle to bosom pal on the far end.
Right.
And so when you meet these people, they're total strangers. And the idea is that you want to move the needle just a little bit every time toward that other end. So the trick to networking is not to talk about yourself. When I'm coaching my students, I'm like, don't, you know, if they bring up work, if they bring up and ask you a question, then answer it. They keep the focus on them. Like, oh, so where'd you grow up? You know, so if I met you and you were a producer, I'm like, oh, you're from Tennessee. Well, you know what? I have a student in Bristol. I had a buddy, who went to college at Belmont there in Nashville. And so where do you live again? Oh, you live on a farm. Oh, yeah, north. It's north of Tennessee, isn't it? Yeah. And so you, and then the last, you know, the key, of course, is you write all that stuff down after you meet them and you get their business card. And that way you can follow up and you can say, you can drop a line to say, hey, you know, how are things in Tennessee, you know, going for you right now? Or, you know, I see the Titans are going to the Super Bowl or who knows what, you know. And so networking is about establishing a personal connection. It is not about, hi, this is me, hire me. That's the artless form of networking. So, you know, but those are the obvious places to go.
Right.
But beyond that too, what's nice is there's, like I said, these other events that are sponsored in the industry that you need to keep your eye out for. And I understand that everybody has a limited budget, so you got to be judicious about
sure
where you go. But that's what I would say.
Well, you do recommend membership in APA.
Yeah, I do. I think it's a smart move. I think, you know, I oftentimes, though, I'll tell some of my brand new students who have, you know, very, very few credits, if any at all, because they're coming in from a different line of VO or different performance area. I tell them, I said, look, you can go to APAC if you want, but don't expect them to take any notice of you because you have no track record.
Right.
I mean, let's just be honest. I mean, it's like a theater actor who graduates from, well, like me, for goodness sake, when I graduated with my BFA in acting from the College of Santa Fe in New Mexico, ever heard of it? No, you know, I didn't go to Juilliard. I didn't go to CalArts. I didn't go to RADA or Lambda, you know. And so I got there and I was a nobody, just like the other thousands of nobodies. And I knew that. So, you know, I mean, it would be ridiculous of me to try to go to a Broadway. I mean, try to expect that I'm going to be picked up for a Broadway or off Broadway or even off Broadway stuff. I had, you know, pay my dues by doing summer stock theater in some sweaty place in Kansas City or Albany, New York, or, you know, working in a little church basement in Brooklyn somewhere. And I had to spend the time. I had to build the resume. And so I tell my beginning students, I said, no, don't join yet. You know, read Audiophile magazine and stay busy online with social media and read what's going on. But don't bother to go until maybe you've got, you know, give it a year and get a couple of titles under your belt.
Right.
And know the lay of the land. I mean, I had a friend recently tell me, she said, it's almost as if you have to go to APAC once to even understand what the hell is going on.
Absolutely.
So the next time you go, you can actually know
right.
how to do it. But there's no way to describe that to a person. You have to experience it.
Let's shift gears just a little bit. So as you're working from home, you've been contacted by Blackstone or whoever has sent you a title. Talk a little bit about from start to end of your work process, your normal work day, working from home, when your prep process, your recording process, how often you record during the day, and then how long it may take you normally to get a title completed. Oh man, there's the music indicating it's time to wrap up this episode. In episode 7, we'll pick up where this one left off. And in episode 8, we'll wrap up our three-part series with Sean Pratt. A really nice guy, a prolific narrator, and a great coach. For everybody right here on the farm, from me, Julie, Riley, y'all enjoy the rest of your week. And we'll talk to you next Monday.